I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder and host of The New Health Club Show. I like to invite you to change your mind about psychedelics because I believe we are entering a new era of health, bodies, and brains. And for this, we need new tools, experts, and thought leaders, which you can meet here at The New Health Club Show. Please enjoy. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of The New Health Club Show. My guest today is David Oren, CEO and co-founder of GABA Labs. He and his team are producing a drink called Sentia, a drink that gives us everything we want from alcohol, just without the alcohol. Sentia is a so-called GABA spirit, the world's first truly functional alcohol alternative category, a blend of functional botanical ingredients designed by the science team at GABA Labs to offer that two-drink sweet spot that we all know. So Sentia enhances your GABA receptors with no alcohol involved, which is kind of a pretty big deal in the future, I think. I also think Sentia is the perfect product for the world of new healths that I start to explore in the meantime, not only psychedelics. So this is a really interesting addition to all these products that are coming our way. Sentia is designed to create the togetherness and celebration we are used to experience, most of us, with alcohol. But what if we would not use alcohol anymore to connect or to have conversations or to celebrate? Also, Sentia has been created with the research support of Professor David Nutt from Imperial College, one of the most important psychedelic researchers contributing to the new psychedelic industry and science. And please check out his organization, Drug Science, which also does amazing work in the field of psychedelics. With over 40 years of experience, David Nutt is one of the world's foremost experts on alcohol and its effects, sometimes of the negative effects of alcohol. David co-founded GABA Labs in order to achieve the vision of bringing greater choices to adult social drinkers. Sentia is the first consumer-facing brand to evolve from this breakthrough work. It's kind of the third way. Neither alcohol nor alcohol-free is just a new tool to actually enhance your GABA receptor. And just for our listeners here, we have a very nice offer for you guys. If you use the code to order a bottle of Sentia or two, please use the code ANNE15 to get 15% of your Sentia order. And please head over to www.sentiaspirits.com, punch in the code ANNE15 for your 15% off and order this amazing drink. The code expires March 31st, so please be fast. The demand is pretty high. And please enjoy the show with David. Great to have you on the show, David Oren, co-founder of Sentia, one of the hottest brands right now. We can say that because half Berlin is asking me about this amazing drink that doesn't have alcohol, but is kind of enhancing your GABA receptors. So, since we will launch this episode in January, which is for a lot of people the so-called dry January, I would really like to go back to the start, how you actually came up with this drink before we go into the ethnobotanical details.
Gosh, that's going back into history. So Sentia was actually, the truth be told, we came up with the idea sitting in Innsbruck Airport.
Oh, well.
Yeah, we'd come out of a meeting with investors and they had said, guys, we love what you're doing with Alcarel, which is our synthetic ingredient that I think will revolutionize the face of drinking. It's a synthetic molecule that does everything you want from alcohol, and it can be very strong or weak, or depending on what you want. But the investors said, well, what are you doing about finding this in nature? And David Nutt, Professor Nutt, and I sat at the airport. It was a heavy snowfall. It was Christmas, five years ago. And I asked David, where can we find GABAergic compounds in nature? And after we were there for 2 days, we couldn't leave. The airport was frozen solid. And after 2 days, we made a plan and we came back to the UK. David went out and recruited a team of scientists who had expertise with plants. And we began to look at the different families of molecules that we were interested in and where they existed within the plant world. And we developed a specification to make a drink that would be not require heavy regulatory testing, that could be made from food-grade plants and that would have a GABAergic impact. We began not knowing whether it would take us anywhere, but we went out, studied the literature, put together a database, 400 different plants, which were known to have some effect in this area. We looked at the biochemistry, and we figured out ways to amplify the effect of GABA in the gut. It passes through the gut wall, its ability to cross the blood-brain barrier, or to enable the appropriate effect across the blood-brain barrier. And Santia was born. Initially, it was a very crude product, very rough. We didn't know how to make it to handle plants. So we had to learn a great deal. We expanded the team and we brought in a brilliant plant expert who really understands how to turn plants into liquids, beautiful liquids. The taste has always been a challenge. You know, this is Centia Black, or this is Centia Red, which is a very sort of berry-like drink. People often like to drink this with a light soda or tonic, elderflower tonic. This is black, very different. Very challenging, much more challenging flavor, but very.
What is a challenging flavor?
Much more.
What does it mean?
But like, also really interesting effect. They're both different. Red is designed to create this sort of slightly aphrodisiacal, warm, candlelit dinner, fireside, one-on-one coziness.
And the black one.
Black is designed for more energy, for interviews.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If you're giving a TED talk. Or if you're attending, a meeting of lawyers where you want to be friends, not enemies. Or you're planning a trip across the Atlantic or your next big business, you might take Centia Black.
Okay.
So they're designed for slightly different effects. And there is a third one coming called Centia Gold, which is designed for parties and networking and talking and being very active, walking around a room and meeting people.
But I mean, let's quickly come back to David Nutt, who is a very famous researcher for those who don't know him. So to me, and I'm sure to the listeners here too, what's so interesting is that a psychedelic scientist and advocate, you could say, has developed this drink. So, and to me, this is already kind of shows a growing connection between the psychedelic world or ecosystem that's building and kind of creating products that are connected to this new, let's say, tool set that we will need in the next, or since yesterday, basically. So how did this collaboration came, this very British collaboration into the world, let's say?
So David is renowned, I think one of the true statements about David is, as a professor, scientist, he's a neuropsychopharmacologist. One of his claims to fame is he's given more drugs to more people than anybody and any other scientist on the planet in experimental conditions. So his vast experience and understanding the different recesses of the brain and how neuroreceptors work has been incredibly valuable. But what we're trying to do here is outside of the scope of the properly defined psychedelic. Psychedelic is really about exploring outside of conventional mind travel and mind experience. Whereas we've set about with Centia and with Alcoral, in fact, to mimic something that people do in a very conventional way. And it's very conventional for humans, and actually not just for humans, but also for animals, mammals, to consume or to seek out the effect of alcohol as part of normal life. So you'll see apes finding fruit on the forest floor and consuming that and drinking the liquid around it, which is alcohol. You'll find caribou traveling across North America, seeking out grasslands with high sugar content grasses during the rainy season. Why? Because they're looking to drink the liquid, which has alcohol. So animals will seek out the effect of alcohol, and that's within a normal... and I think humans have been doing that for many thousands of years. And what we're trying to do is work within that much more conventional frame. We could produce sentia or effects using solids. We could make chocolate or cake. But people like to share a glass. The sharing a glass has become a habitual thing. And I think tapping into that, what has now become a normal, innate human activity, which is to come together and share a glass, that's an important social act which goes across cultures. And I think tapping into that and providing that healthy exchange with liquids that don't do the damage of alcohol is our goal.
So, I mean, you're already mentioning it. Like, I think it's the first thing I also heard about David Nutt, the so-called Nutt chart that shows us how alcohol is the most dangerous substance for human beings in terms of a heavy consumption. And the last one is, mushrooms. Mm. It's actually Christian Angermeyer told me about the Nutt chart years ago. Mm. So, but now, interesting enough, like roughly 4 years later, you go on Instagram and every 10th post is telling you, or every 10th podcast, like Andrew Huberman, all the big podcasts really addressing the harm that alcohol can do actually to human beings. Sometimes not only in terms of an alcoholic consumption. So it also comes into the discussion now with the whole longevity topic, like how it actually affects your brain in the long term. And I would say, I mean, roughly like 5 to 10 years ago, in the media world where I come from mainly, I mean, it was pretty much super normal to have like every night like a party or like drinks. And now this seems to be really becoming or getting into question if this is the way we, like you say, it still should come together. So if somebody would ask you, so what is so dangerous about alcohol? How do you answer this?
I think that it's the ignorance that we have of alcohol that has been the danger. Alcohol itself doesn't do any harm unless you consume it in excess. And I have drunk a lot of alcohol in my life. I grew up thinking that alcohol was what you did as you became an adult. In fact, it was a sign of being an adult that you drank alcohol and stopped drinking Coca-Cola. But alcohol's been with us for so long, and we've become dependent upon that social act. And that social act is actually also very positive and very important for us. So it isn't simply that alcohol is bad. It's not that alcohol is bad. It's the effect that we have from alcohol when we drink in excess that is bad. But the effect of alcohol is really important to us. And that effect we need to preserve. The idea that people can come together and be open to each other, that our GABA receptors are activated and that we are available and that we can connect, so that when I speak with somebody, I'm sharing myself. Sometimes, you know, with alcohol, instead of sharing ourselves, we share the alcohol and we speak for alcohol. And sometimes I don't know if it happens to you, but I can be in a pub and people are shouting. And I'm thinking, they're not speaking, they're shouting. It isn't the person that's talking, it's the bottle. And that's the thing that I personally don't like. But I think that the act of coming together and being open and available to each other is really part of who we are. It's part of humanity. And I think we need to find ways to make that happen easily. My dream is that we restore the English pub. The English pub used to sell beer with very, very low alcohol content. Why? Because it was the healthiest liquid. The water from the river was polluted, so we drank alcoholic water. and pubs sold that. It was part of refreshment. I'd like to restore the English pub and make the English pub a place of safety where we all go. Not because, well, I've only been twice this week, I can go one more time. No, we go to get better. Not just from eating, but spiritually as well. We go to connect and we go to get better from what we consume, because what we consume is healthy. And so we're doing a lot of work into the health impact of activating GABA. We're doing this at a number of different research institutions in the UK, and we do expect to publish data on this. I believe the future is very bright and very encouraging with GABA active alternatives to alcohol.
So how can you quickly, I know it's like a pharmacological discussion, but how could you quickly describe the GABA receptor and what does it actually do?
The way I look at this, and I'm an engineer, my background is engineering and disruptive technology and innovation. I only came into this with David in 2015. But the way that I understand the receptor system is like my car. I have an accelerator, which is glutamate. It's what gives you the energy. It's what allows you to eat, live, you know, and as basic animals to kill and procreate and so on. And your car has an accelerator. Without the accelerator, it wouldn't work. But if it only had the accelerator, you would have a wonderful car in a straight line and then you would die. So we need a brake. And the brake modulates the energy of the vehicle. And the brake is the GABA system. The brake allows you to modulate that energy. And if those two are in balance, then we can have a safe journey. And when we have a safe journey, we're relaxed. And then we can wind the window down, which might be the serotonin. We can turn on the music, which might be the dopamine. We might have oxytocin, which might be the air conditioning. We can engage other systems, or the body naturally engages all the other neuroreceptors. But if glutamate and GABA are fighting each other, if you're accelerating and braking at the same time, which is what alcohol does, alcohol activates the glutamate and it activates the GABA at the same time. It creates chaos. And then it goes on and overwhelms the dopamine and the serotonin and the oxytocin, and it does everything else. It invades everywhere. It's a small molecule. So it invades every part of the brain, every part of the body, and then deposits acetaldehyde. So first of all, it creates chaos, emotional chaos, and then it creates physical damage and physical wreckage. It's very equivalent to me of experiencing a car, accelerating and braking at the same time, turning on the radio and up, music going up and, you know, music volume high, windows going up and down, windscreen wipers. You'd be crazy. That's kind of where alcohol takes you. Whereas what we've tried to do is identify compounds and ingredients that activate GABA in the particular combination of sublevels of the GABA receptor, which allows you to physically and emotionally relax and tune in to the person that you're with.
So walk me through the, let's say we have the black drink you just showed. So let's say you have like a pure, you don't mix it with something, you might put like an ice cube, couple of ice cubes in it. So, and you're with a person, you have a drink with that person or a couple of people. So, and then how is the ritual? Because with alcohol, you just, let's say you're in a bar, you order it, you start drinking, and pretty much everybody knows what's going to happen. Some people get drunk faster, some people drink, you know. But for example, if you're with a group, then you go, you need another glass. Why do you drink so slow? Like, I'm a slow drinker, so I'm always the one with the full glass. So, so what is happening once you, let's say, have this drink in front of you and you start to the first zips? How long does it last? When you feel something? And are you still on the same level with these other people?
So first of all, it isn't the same as alcohol. It is different. Mm-hmm. And we're beginning to gather data, real measurements of the reduction of anxiety that occurs with the consumption of Sentia. And we're doing that by laboratory experiments, which are specific, which are directly measuring the oscillation of anxiety that happens in, for example, in the stomach, and the baseline of that anxiety, how it can drop or be affected. And you can measure that. And you can see that happen with alcohol. So you may have an amplitude of anxiety like this, and you may have a baseline here, and that amplitude will shorten and drop with alcohol. But very quickly with alcohol, with ethanol, you will see that amplitude return and go back and continue different to before, but it will return and come and close to what it was before. Whereas with the materials that we use, you can measure the same phenomena, and you'll see that amplitude of anxiety is reduced significantly and the baseline drops and stays lower. So you have a reduction in the phenomena, which is translates to anxiety. But it's not the same as alcohol. So it doesn't then go on and invade your dopamine and drive you to want more, drive you to have the feelings of I need more. And in fact, many people report, this is anecdotal information, but many people do report that drinking Sentia actually allows them to feel satiated, satisfied, mm-hmm. and not wanting more. My sister, she's a therapist. She's a specialized therapist, and she works long hours and strange hours. And she claims that drinking Sentia one evening with her friends, the next 2 days, she can work very easily and feel very, very calm, relaxed, and satisfied, and so on. And with a reduced hunger and a reduced desire to consume something. So I think that alcohol leaves many people with a desire to need more. And Sentia, in my experience and the experience of many, is the opposite. It actually helps to satisfy and make people feel fairly calm and relaxed and not needing something else.
Can you drive on Sentia?
We recommend that people don't drive. And the reason okay. we recommend is Sentia is designed to relax. And we cannot predict the level of alertness or relaxation that is safe. So we make the recommendation, if you're going to drink Sentia, don't drive. But the question is for how long and how does it affect individuals? So I think we have to be intelligent adults and we have to be aware of ourselves. We have to listen to our own bodies. But my recommendation is don't drink for 40 minutes after a glass of Sentia. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I mean, interesting enough, you would think more of the drinks as something at a bar than in nightlife, for example, so far. But I mean, so something I immediately thought about is that, let's say, this lends itself also to be a drink that eventually might be consumed with psychedelics. I mean, for example, let's say a very popular thing in Berlin, and I think in England too, is let's say to take recreational MDMA with your friends, even a little bit. But then obviously you should not drink alcohol because that's what people always did in rave times here. But I mean, as we know, it's not a good idea. So do you think that Sentia will be a drink also that is actually perfect to enjoy with microdoses of psychedelics at one point?
We don't have enough experience and we haven't gathered data. We do know that Sentia is being consumed and ordered and consumed and purchased for social events that take place outside of public environments. There was a rave here in Bristol, where I am now, on January 1. It began at 10 in the morning and went on into the evening.
Oh, wow.
And I was invited to go and I couldn't for a reason. But I also thought on January the 1, I mean, most people will be asleep getting over the night before. Actually, it was a sober rave and 500 people attended and it was a blowout success. We provided Sentia and Sentia was the primary, kind of experience. And the report I got back was incredible. And I can't find it right now, but I'd like to read you what they said. People really enjoyed it. They experimented widely with a lot of different mixes and cocktails. They were very imaginative and creative in how they used Sentia. They had Sentia red and black. But the report back was absolutely fantastic. But these were people who chose to attend a sober rave on the 1st of January. So I think that, and I don't know what else was consumed at that, but I'm guessing Sentia wasn't the only thing, and it may well be that people chose to take MDMA. I don't know. Yeah.
But still, I mean, and I think we talked about this already last conversation, that you can really see how the dominance of alcohol, let's say, I mean, here in Berlin, in this nightlife, or in this going out in the evening, I mean, it's still there. But for example, there's this club called Barkhain, a very famous club here. And the last time I was there months ago with friends, and I was watching the bar, and nobody ordered alcohol. It was maybe one guy ordering a beer, then the others would order mate or water. So it's almost like redundant to have all this alcohol sitting there. So, and I find especially like a certain maybe younger generation, but also a generation that maybe is now looking into a psychedelic experience or like therapy even, is actually stepping away from alcohol. And I feel like some people also started to do this because they felt that besides the physical, you know, like downside and what affects your cell and your mitochondria. So, and, but it's also bringing up kind of unresolved trauma in people. Mm-hmm. Like, and I remember, I'm sure you have to remember that too, like on some parties or some events with some people who were just nicely drunk and then something switched and they became either so-called raging alcoholics or like were starting crying and everything. And I feel this is something that is also like almost like a taboo thing, like in terms of drinking alcohol. Is this something that goes into the research also when you research, Santia?
I think we've seen that because alcohol doesn't just activate GABA. GABA is the first thing that alcohol does. First thing it does is touch is GABA. But then it goes on immediately to then activate other receptors, which can be in conflict with GABA. And we're all different. And so our receptiveness and openness and the extent to which we are on GABA or glutamate or dopamine or serotonin or oxytocin is activated can be different degrees. And so we will respond differently as the alcohol invades each of those different neurosystems. And I think we will behave differently and that will activate memories and experiences from the past. We have, all of the work that we have done from a scientific point of view has been to be very narrow and to only activate the GABA side. And by doing that, we avoid creating that potentially unpredictable chaos that happens when you activate a lot of other things, which have consequences that we don't want. Dopamine is, you know, activating dopamine can have very negative, addictive consequences. Alcohol does do that. We do everything that we can to avoid that. So I think that chaos of pressing the accelerator and the brake and activating the radio and the CD player and the telephone and the windows going up and down and the windscreen wipers can create experiences that are not pleasant. And I think alcohol, and the more we drink alcohol, the more alcohol progresses through our neurosystem, the more likely we are to experience things that we didn't anticipate or don't want, we wouldn't choose. Now, that's not to say that alcohol is terrible. I enjoy a glass of wine and I still enjoy a glass of single malt. But I'm aware of the potential negative aspects of it.
But you were saying also the dopamine topic is also something that we start to hear a lot, that basically reflecting on your dopamine level and what it creates in you, either if it's shopping or like, you know, drinking or like kind of addictive for you, addictive things to do. But I find interesting that this expression sober has this huge comeback right now. And I mean, of course, I remember living in California, there was always like California sober. And I think it means people were smoking pot, but not drinking, wasn't also not really the solution to a lot of things. But I mean, I remember writing 2016, I wrote a story about the so-called like cannabis luxury industry. Like, it, you know, these kind of fancy looking vape pens started to come on. And I think it was in LA, Saks Fifth Avenue had this floor of products, and this floor was called High Times, meaning it was only kind of cannabis equipment, the whole, kind of luxury products around this renaissance of cannabis, or like the introduction of actual California sober. So, and another thing in this time was that a lot of cannabis companies tried to create specific flavors, and like what you said earlier, like if you want to feel like this, then you should smoke this or vape this. Mm. If you want to feel active, vape this. If you want to do Netflix and chill, do this. If you want to be creative, do this. So do we have this desire to kind of create our emotions today as opposed to maybe 20, 30 years ago? Do we want to control them also with new substances? Do you think that's the case?
I think it's a really good question. You know, is the choice that we have now to control how we feel, or is it instead to feel who we really are?
Yeah.
And that's different. And I think with alcohol, eventually you end up feeling whatever it is that alcohol makes you feel. And you're not eventually you're not in control. What I want from the things that we do as a company, what we want as a company, is for people to be able to choose to be themselves with other people and to explore who they are and to explore that relationship with other people. So I'm really not interested in controlling how people feel. I want people to be able to explore that and to discover that themselves. I was in until about 4 or 5 years ago, I used to be a basketball coach on the weekends. For my kids, you know, I used to help 25 kids come together on Saturdays. And at the end of it, we'd go to the pub. And I always enjoyed going to the pub. You know, you've got kids and adults, and it's a nice, healthy environment. A lot of noise going on. A lot of, you know, sometimes we had to leave the pub and go to a different pub because the kids were making too much noise. And then one day I took my daughter up to Manchester University, and we went to a shisha restaurant where people smoke from a shisha pipe, but no alcohol. And what I could see is that everyone who walked into the room was acknowledged by other people. Their eyes met. When they came to the table, everybody at the table made room for them. Their eyes synchronized. They smiled. They spoke quickly to everybody. What I noticed is that although everybody was engaged in conversation, the noise level was much less. And people were actually smiling and connecting instead of one person dominating the conversation, which was pretty much how the pub works, where you have somebody shouting to be because he thinks or she is very, very interesting. And everybody had to listen. In this restaurant, it was different. It was far more exciting to me to watch this, and interesting and lovely, quite lovely. Much more democratic, much more engagement, much more connection. I feel as though people will go home from that evening feeling emotionally way more 100%, whereas people from the pub will have gone home being less than they could be, my feeling. So I feel as though the choice is not us making you feel one way or another. I think the choice is allowing people to explore each other more easily, to connect more easily and find out who the other person is and to find out who they are in that exchange. And that's what GABA allows. It allows that openness, that connection, that conviviality.
But I mean, it seems anyway that that's the thing that most people have not learned or even lost in COVID, the art of connection, or that it kind of was kind of harmed because of, I mean, as great as it is, we have all these Zoom calls and we don't have to travel around the world. But I mean, it's funny that still today, like really serious meetings, people start to come back to personal meetings again instead of just hopping on a call. And I mean, we can record this podcast now because of better technology, but So it seems that my observation is also that more people are actually craving for a connection support that they might not know it before anyway, but after COVID, it was actually worse than it was already before COVID. But I want to quickly come back to this sober thing, because I mean, I remember there were a couple of articles, I'm sure, in all the Western countries when journalists were starting to write, oh, I stopped drinking, I had to or I wanted to, and now I go into a group of people and everybody's first kind of expelling me almost in a way, saying like, oh, why don't you, you're not fun anymore, you don't drink, and that you actually are expelled from society in a way. So, and I would think that in the main parts of our Western societies, this would still be the case. So, and I find it also interesting that, and I'm sure that was in England the same thing, that here there was this whole wave of alcohol-free drinks, like beer and wine and everything. But then you could see that people were also really almost like annoyed by it and drank even more in this secretly hoping that it would be some alcohol somewhere in the end of the bottle hidden or something. Mm. So how do you think this will contribute to creating a new way of celebration if you're with a couple of people, if you're not like in a one-on-one situation or in an intimate group of people? I remember you told me you had this press event and it was actually everybody drank Santia, and it was you said it was a wild party. How do we have to imagine this with a new way of drinks or a new style of drinks that's coming our way?
So the question is, what expectations can we have?
Yeah,
for parties and social get-togethers in the future. I think you're right. It's taking a little bit of time for society to adjust, and we're adjusting at different paces in different countries and different age groups. How will we adjust to moving from an alcohol-driven social engagement to no alcohol? And there was a time when people drank zero alcohol only because they were driving or because they were on medication or some other reason. And then we had to drink things that were horrible, zero alcohol drinks that didn't taste of anything. And then the alcohol company started to experiment with flavors and colors and sugar. And then so then we were supposed to drink zero alcohol drinks that would basically sugared water with different types of flavoring and labels. But with functional drinks like Sentia and Alcarol when it's available, we can actually feel some of the things that we want from alcohol. And our goal is to release products that are not as strong as vodka, not as strong as whiskey, something in the range of a wine, that sort of strength, a beer and a wine. Right now, we can make, even with botanicals, we can make the most amazing beers and cider and sparkling wine. We can make a champagne-like product that will feel just like a good champagne. We haven't released those products. We hope during 2024 to find partners that will then, we don't want to own the product. We want to simply provide the ingredient. But we expect to release these products in certain countries during 2024. And I think that's going to open up way more choice, where we can expect to go to a party and enjoy the same good feelings that other people want from their champagne or from their beer, but without the negative. And I think that's, I think you should ask me then what the future is going to look like, because we all have more experience of how people use these. The event that you're talking about took place in London, where for the first time we made available to members, people who are not members of our team, to outsiders, and it was the press, we made available to them something like a champagne with the full effect, ciders with the full effect, beers with the full effect, without any alcohol, but with the effect of alcohol. And the initial response was caution, skepticism, conservative, not being sure, uncertainty. But by the end of the evening, the room was full of noise and laughter, and and people were having a really enjoyable time, like any healthy party. And people didn't want to leave, and we have to be asked to leave the building. And that's been our, by the way, that's been our experience with Sentia as well. When David, when we first put Sentia together, David Nutt is a chairman of a charity called Drug Science, which is a research charity that does work into the use of substances and the abuse and the property and how to improve medical access to the right substances. And they do a number of public events. We began to make our product, Sentia, available, and it changed those events. People, instead of leaving just after the speeches, just after the teach-in, people stayed.
That's interesting.
And they would stay for as long as they could until the security of the building asked us to leave. And then they would walk out talking together. So having access to something like Sentia, and we used to offer wine before. David, Drug Science used to offer wine, but introducing Sentia just changed the dynamic. It allowed for more real conversation, and conversation that was sticky, and people wanted to continue the conversation and then would stand outside and carry on talking. So I think it's too early to say how this will affect all of society, but I'm watching with great curiosity every time we release another product and take it to another venue, how will this... For example, I'm so sorry that I missed the rave on the 1st of January. 500 people, I really thought it was going to flop. You know, a rave on the 1st of January, I think everybody should be getting over the hangover from the night before. Mm. No, 500 people turned up, and apparently it was a storming success. And people really, really enjoyed the Sentia. No alcohol was served. So I think that everything that we do now is becoming, and we're very curious. We're learning as we go. And we want feedback. We want people to tell us, are we going in the right direction? Is this what we should do? So I can give you my thoughts on what I've seen, but I can't predict the future. What I can predict is that human beings are amazing. And if we're allowed to be ourselves, and if we're able to connect with each other and truly make contact, then, wow, what can happen then can be incredible. And that's what we want to unlock.
Isn't it that this sounds like a nice idea, especially the red one, the red version, like a potion that we used to have these kind of potions and mixtures. And there's this great book by Brian Murarescu, The Immortality Key, who you certainly know, I'm sure, where he talks about the LSD spiked beer, you could say, that was a psychedelic beer. And then when only women were allowed to kind of produce it. And when the Catholic Church became really serious, they took out the LSD and the women too. So it just stayed regular beer. But it seems that there's a whole history of potions and little, today you would say supplements, that we start to rediscover right now. Like, for example, with canna as an equivalent, said it very simply now, but to a natural MDMA, then even coca leaves are rediscovered by a couple of Canadian companies looking into them as just a stimulant and not an illegal drug. So is Sentia also, like the company, are you guys also looking into other, let's say, ethnobotanical surprises for the next years?
So I think that's a really good question. And we have a lot of choices, but the primary purpose, we have to remember what our primary purpose is with Sentia. Sentia, we're not, in fact, if you say, well, what does my company do and what is our goal? We are not really a drinks company. We aren't here to create drinks. We're more of a research-based organization. Our goal is to develop an ingredient, Alkarel, and to bring that to the market. And if we can bring Alkarel to the market in the USA by 2026, then we can make available in the USA an ingredient that we can license to ingredient companies for them to supply drinks, brand, majors. So we would expect Coors and Diageo and AB InBev and Heineken and Carlsberg and et cetera, to then begin to use Alkarel as an alternative to alcohol in their drink. And we would expect a new generation of drink products, which activate GABA and allow you to feel like you're drinking alcohol, the good part of it, but without all that negative baggage that comes with alcohol. Now, that's my number one goal as a company. That's what our company's goal is. So you might say, David, well, you've got a couple of wonderful products here, Sentia Red, Sentia Black. Why are you doing that if your goal is Alcarol? And the reason that we're doing Sentia Red and Sentia Black is really it's a proof of concept. Because it's very hard to communicate the idea of GABA unless you can isolate it and allow people to test it. And saying that we're going to replace alcohol as the primary ingredient in social drinking is a very big claim. To explain how GABA works intellectually is very difficult. So we needed an alternative. We needed a proof of concept. And that's what Sentia is. So we have, although we're very excited about plants, and you know, we've done a lot of research on plants from South America, from the Amazon, and plants from Australia and Africa, and even from the USA. And we have a database of 400 plants, each of which has particular benefits. Our main goal is to demonstrate the role of GABA and activating GABA. I think at some point we will no longer own Sentia. We will allow Sentia to be purchased by another company. So somebody else will acquire Sentia and we will focus much more on Alcarol as an ingredient. And we'll go back to our core Alcarol roots. So Sentia is something that's developed very rapidly. It's been very successful. People love it. We're having to increase production. We're under pressure to produce more versions. I've described the ciders and the champagne and so on. But our core root and our core goal ultimately is Alcarol. And it's bringing that to market because that itself will generate a revolution in social drinking and social connection. And I think we'll create a new generation of drinks and a massive amount of experimentation. And a lot of new companies and brands will be created that will generate that new generation of that will create that new generation of beverages. And I think that's where innovation will really take off. Right now, innovation is either around sugars and color and flavor or stuff that's outside of legal framework. I think what we want to create is a revolution within that legal framework where GABA can be activated across a vast range of drink formats.
So the Alcarol is actually activating the GABA receptor. That's what it does.
That's what Alcarol does. It is specifically targeted very narrowly to activate the GABA receptor and a particular combination of sublevels within the GABA receptor, and not GABA everywhere, but only in a very localized part of our brain. So it's designed for a very narrow function for a number of reasons. One is because that's the positive effect that we believe alcohol provides. And also because we want minimal impact upon the human body. We just want to activate the bit that feels good without doing all the other stuff that alcohol does.
And I mean, the question rises very fast, similar again to the psychedelic industry, where you would have the problem that some people see, once big pharma knows about this, sees psychedelic therapy or like psychedelic research. I mean, today we just heard that Atai is investing $50 million in Beckley Psytech. So the pharma thing is kind of happening. Mm. And a lot of critics say in the psychedelic industry say, well, I mean, the pharma arm will take over all the other, you know, engagements in this industry. And of course, I could imagine that this is something you might think about too, that the classic alcohol industry in the world, which is a super strong, probably one of the biggest industries, is trying to kind of prevent this kind of redefinition of drinking and alcohol. So are there already kind of experiences you're having where you get like lawsuits or, I mean, you don't have to go into detail, but I'm wondering.
Yeah. So, you know, the question really is, how will big alcohol respond? When we began our journey, which is back in 2015, there was in my mind, this didn't represent a real market opportunity. Instead, it represented a labor of love. It represented a mission that David Nutt was on, and he was the leader. And I considered him initially to be a little bit crazy. You know, he wanted to create a synthetic alcohol. Why? Why? We've already got an alcohol. Why do you want to create another one? His answer was, I've got a better one. I said, well, do we need a better one, really? It's only by understanding the problem of alcohol and the damage that it does that I began to realize that this is an important conversation. But even then, that didn't make it a business opportunity, because the vision of big alcohol and how they would respond was huge. And there was no evidence. There was minimal evidence at the time that this generation would change the world the way that this generation is changing the world in terms of its demand for healthy consumption. So it didn't look like a business or market opportunity, but it did look like a mission that was worth supporting, you know, but almost like a mission you do from a religious conviction point of view, not because it's a market opportunity. So I gave David my help initially, and I said, yeah, I'll help you. But I didn't think of it as a business. I thought of it as more as a place to lose some money. What's happened in the 8 years since then is that the world has changed. This generation has changed the way that markets work. This generation is actively seeking healthier alternatives. They're looking for ways to be more relaxed, to de-stress in a world which is increasingly stressful, and to consume food and drink and less pharmaceuticals. Younger people are looking for food to be the source of health, and to avoid the need for medicine. So they're looking for ways to live that will provide a healthier, longer life. And that goes hand in hand with the older generation that is now more educated. The older generation now has a much better understanding of the impact of alcohol than we ever did. I have only learned in the last 10 years about the impact of alcohol. When I was younger, I didn't care. I thought I would live forever and I was made of rubber and I would always be older. You know, I would never have to restrict myself on anything. So there's the older generation that's growing up, and has now learned a great deal. And much of what we've learned from the younger generation. You know, I was rather shocked when my children told me they didn't drink alcohol at college because they thought grass was healthier. They thought grass was okay, but alcohol was unhealthy. And I thought, wow, okay, gosh, you know, interesting. We've all learned from the younger generation. So there's two things going on. The older generation, which has money, disposable income, is spending money and experimenting with life hacking methods and ways to consume more healthily. And then the young generation is pushing forward. They've never actually been hooked on alcohol. So it's not that they're looking for alternatives to alcohol. They're looking for ways to relax and to consume in a healthy way. So they have a different driver. And that's all happened really since 2015. And by 2030, the world will look very, very different. By 2030, alcohol will be in the market. We will have wide experience of the adoption and consumption of alcohol in America. We probably will have landed in Europe by then. So I think that I think social drinking, celebration landscape will look very different. We also expect the botanicals will have evolved tremendously. We're working right now to develop stronger botanicals and to identify different and to develop different formats of drinks, different types of drinks with botanicals. And we expect that the botanicals market will also be quite substantial. We think that Alcarel will be much larger because of the fact that we can use Alcarel to create any drink very, very easily, whereas it takes quite a lot of time and investment to create a new botanical that is an acceptable botanical and that is successful. So I think by 2030, the world will have continued and this generation will have grown up and will have more disposable income and will be having an even greater impact upon how markets work.
So botanical is something like Santia right now.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Not all botanicals are functional, but we are looking to license some of our technology to other companies so that other people can make botanicals, functional botanicals. Germany is really important for us as a market. Germany is the most advanced. Germany's ahead of the UK. You know, in Europe, it's really Germany number one, then the UK, maybe Spain in terms of experience and demand and sophistication. So Germany is really important for us, and I wish that we were in Germany already. I would love to find
you. Will be there very soon.
I know we're coming to visit you guys. I would love to have a good German partner that would help us to launch German branded products in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, we're working on that. But I mean, if you look back at the, I mean, it's almost like the history of alcohol. It's like so interesting how it is connected with the idea of culture and creativity in a bigger, you know, in a bigger scale in the 20th century, like painters, writers, I don't know, like the whole movie industry, like entertainment is so, I felt it was so strongly connected to, or is still maybe so strongly connected to alcohol. I mean, other substances too, but alcohol is really the number one. I mean, or even, for example, like dating, you meet for a drink. Like the drink, it's always a drink, it's always alcohol. So do you think this is also like a cultural revolution we're experiencing, not only like a health-related, oh, let's become healthier, let's live longer. It's also the outcome of cultural products might be completely different with that, don't you think?
I think it's true that alcohol has found its way into the center of our culture, has almost edged out everything else and forced its way in. It's in the middle of the table. And, you know, it's all about me. And then there's a whole story around the origins of this wine and then the heritage. And so we often care more about the origins of the wine than actually do we really like it or not. The history and so on becomes important. And we look at the label and does the label effuse history or tradition? And so we measure the value of a brand from our understanding of its provenance. I think there's a lot of marketing has happened to create that. But I also think that the thing that that we share between us, and when we all arrive together at a table, you know, the one thing that we all share is whatever it is that we're drinking. So it's the thing that connects everybody together. And then it's the thing that activates your GABA and allows the human connection to happen. So we begin to talk with each other more as a result of that thing that
so
we consume.
Do you mind turning off the notifications a little bit? That's a little bit, I just want to make sure we have to, good. We have a really good recording.
Yeah. So I think it's a combination.
Yeah.
I think there's been a lot of money behind alcohol marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, the large alcohol companies in most developed countries will fund both sides of parliament. They will, and why? I don't think you'll ever find an alcohol company bribing one party or other, but they will fund both sides. And then they will be very happy to withdraw funding when a party takes a position that's not favorable to them. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of a pattern of behavior and a funding. The same thing with press, you know, newspapers that take an anti-alcohol stand may lose out on press advertising.
Yeah.
And so you've got, you know, there's a lot of money talks and alcohol, you know, 70% of alcoholic drinks expenditure is on branding, marketing. And that money is going to the organizations that communicate and media, you communicate with Joe Public. So messaging is highly influenced by the interests of the alcohol industry. So it's only natural that alcohol will have had a very special place in our imaginations and in our culture. But if you go back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient Egypt, even then alcohol played a major part of culture. And much of the ceremonies and the imagery and the art from those times will show the role of alcohol as being central, not just to the festivity itself, but also to the economy surrounding the populations that enjoyed those festivities. It's thought that alcohol may have played the primary role in the evolution of money exchange. You know, the invention or the discovery of grain that could be produced and thrashed in large quantities because of a defect that allowed it to be easily converted into usable sugar-based material for creation of foods, allowed the creation of alcohol and the very rapid evolution of an alcohol industry where alcohol became a form of exchange. A form of exchange that allowed populations to move to essentially begin wage labor where payment was in the form of alcohol. So alcohol has played a massive role, not just in modern times, but going way back to the origins of society. David Nutt will talk about his belief that many of the large Stonehenge and other locations like Stonehenge were essentially places where wonderful parties would take place. He wrote in one of his books about the origins of civilization in Greece, of the legal structures which arose out of the need to formalize governance of festivities, which took place for weeks at a time, where alcohol played, you know, people came together to drink large quantities of alcohol, and people who didn't know each other from different cities came together. And that was a way in which society became more socialized and a level of stability and mutual dependence began to emerge. And after that came laws for governing that mass of people coming together. And alcohol underlay that. You know, so one argument is that the modern society that we have was created through alcohol-induced celebration and people being drunk, basically, and needing to manage that situation. Yes, alcohol plays a central role. It is partly advertising, but it's also innate that the thing that brings us together and that has brought us together for 10,000 years and more should have a fairly important place. And it's interesting that it's the same technology that we use today. You know, 10,000 years ago, we were using wood, I guess, for heat, and then we moved to coal, and then oil and gas, and now we use solar. But we're still using the same technology for alcohol. And it's difficult to imagine any other aspect of life where we're still using the same technology as 10,000 years ago.
But I mean, it's also that it seems that, for example, also if creative people start to talk about their psychedelic experiences, like, for example, the director of Dune, who, you know, like the Denis Villeneuve, who talks about his magic mushroom trips before he wrote the script for Dune. He's not the only one, but he was pretty open about it. So it's almost like if you watched a movie, it presents you a different perception of almost like a different reality, a different story, like not different, but also like it's about a bigger universe. It's not only, oh, the bad guy, the good guy, whoa, they figure it out. And one of them gets the money or the girl or both. So it's more like it has so many ways to look at the world. And I want to say that it has to do because it has to do something with the fact that the director is opening up to psychedelics. Do you also think that we need new ways of looking at the world right now, or at ourselves? Because it seems that in many ways, a lot of things are no longer working, or we realize, things come to the surface that were hidden for a long time, or like you could always kind of work around them. But now it is obviously nothing ever happens that doesn't want to come to the surface. So is this also reflecting in substances that we're looking into or drinking, do you think?
I don't think the world is difficult to understand. That's my own. Mm-hmm. I'm a strong believer in science, in rational thought. And on a personal level, I don't feel the need to use substances to understand the world. I might consider using a substance to be momentarily relaxed, but not because I need to use that as a journey to understand the world. I think we can understand the world through rational eyes and through conversation and through thought and through writing things down and critical thought. So that's my approach. And I have never met anyone who has shown me that their understanding of the world has been advanced through the use of substances. Now, David Nutt may disagree with me, and we don't always agree on things, but that's my approach. So I'm naturally much more structured in my thinking. And I think we can go a long way by using reason. However, we are going through a period in which our environment, the environment that human beings find themselves in, is changing more rapidly than ever in the past. And our bodies haven't necessarily adapted, and our brains haven't adapted to be able to manage that rate of change in the way that we're experiencing. And so we're going through a journey of unknowns. And it may be that I'm wrong, but so far, I feel as though even if you're traveling on a ship through fog, the use of reason and the use of knowledge that we have, observed fact, is more valuable than perhaps putting that to one side. So therefore I tend to operate within a more conventional framework of where the mind is, which is why I'm interested in alcohol and the alternatives to alcohol. Because the majority of society on a daily routine basis has to operate within that in order to function. And I think that alcohol provides something very valuable, but also very damaging. So my focus, I think the focus for the company is to function, is to provide a better solution and better alternatives, better options for a society that does that. I'll give you an example. Somebody that operates an offshore oil platform or that drives an aeroplane with 400 passengers or that operates a fire engine or that has to recover injured people on a highway because they drive an ambulance. Those people have to operate today in the here and now, 24 hours, and they have to operate at a high level of physical and mental performance. They also have to relax. And when they relax, they have to know they can go back into work fairly quickly and function at a high level of performance. And what my company is about is allowing those people and other humans who have to perform in a normal way to be able to relax offline, but come back into the work environment feeling very good and physically relaxed. After an evening drinking Sensi with friends, I feel amazing. I sleep incredibly well. I wake up in the morning without a hangover. My mind is crystal clear. I'm full of energy, and I want to go, and I want to be alive. Whereas I know if I spend an evening with friends drinking single malt whiskey, that's not going to be true. I will be different. So I think we are operating at that level, giving people options to operate at their best and to be at their best with friends. So I think I may have mentioned last time we spoke, one of the things that drove me to do this with Senti and with Alcarel is a conversation I had with a young lady. She was telling me about her experience. She's a friend of my daughter's, and she was telling me about her experience at university. She said she hadn't enjoyed it. I said, oh, so I had an amazing time at university. She hadn't enjoyed it. I asked why. She said, she didn't get to know many people. That's strange, because I was familiar with the university which I went to, and there were a lot of parties, and I definitely met a lot of people, enjoyed it. She said, no, she remembered walking down the corridor when she arrived to a party she'd been invited to. The closer she got to the door, the more nervous she became. She could hear everybody having a great time on the other side of the door. And when she got to the door, she stopped and then decided to turn around and go back to her room, because she was actually frightened to walk through the door.
Interesting.
And so she missed out on an opportunity to get to that. And that kind of stayed with her. And so she became slightly detached, and she didn't become engaged. She didn't develop a lot of friends at the university because she was very shy. And I'm sure the world would have been different had she walked through the door and actually just been available to communicate with people and get to know people. She would have been welcomed. And I think that's the thing that we're looking for. We're not looking to re-understand the world. We're just looking to open to enable that doorway to be opened more easily.
Yeah, there's so many situations that come to mind where alcohol is like a normal thing to do. And because you are too shy, you feel like an outsider, or you don't want to be the only one not drinking, like so many equations where it's like, where you don't think about it anymore. And, but a lot of people, if I have conversations, especially about times in media, looking back at this, it was really a time where there was way too much alcohol and it was the absolute normality. And if you wouldn't, again, like you say, if you wouldn't engage, you would be maybe missing out on a really great job that would be offered to you at the end of the night, or like the acquaintance of a powerful person that could help you to, and so on, kind of. And I mean, this whole system, it's very fascinating to me how this is falling apart, eventually would fall apart. Also like a power structure that is no longer working, obviously. So, but before we go, I want to know what the golden, the third drink is going to be like. You just quickly mentioned it.
So, yeah. So red was, Sentia Red was the first product. Sentia Black came along. Sentia Black, Red took maybe 3 years to develop, 4 years. Sentia Black took 2 years. Gold has been very slow to develop, largely because of the color. So its main purpose is to be much more of a high energy. It will lead to much more vivacious interaction and physical energy. My sister, I often use my sister as an example. She claims that when she brings her friends together with Sentia Red, everybody sits back into the sofa. You kind of sit back and lean back and they're relaxed. When they drink black, they lean forward because they're much more engaged. Okay. You'll physically see them move forward and connect. They want to be part of the conversation. So it's more for a group conversation. Mm-hmm. With Sentia Gold, you'll see people stand up. They want to naturally
dance.
they want to move around. So we took Sentia Red, black and gold to London, to a gentleman. He owns a number of nightclubs. And he was only interested in gold, wasn't interested in red, wasn't interested in black, but he wanted gold. I think he was a very wealthy man. He would have bought the whole company if he could, but it wasn't for sale, just because of gold,
Wow.
And so that was quite interesting. And he offered it, his business partner was there, his business partner agreed. And then his girlfriend came in. And he said to her, "What do you think? Which one?" She said, "Oh, gold." He says, "I want to buy the..." She said, "Yeah, absolutely." So there was a unanimity on gold for that environment, which is like a high energy, you know, nightclub. But it's not designed for nightclub. And in fact, none of our products really are designed for nightclubs. They're designed for people to come together. And in fact, most of Sentia is drunk not in nightclubs or pubs even. It's drunk at home with friends. It's drunk in the garden, on a beach, it's drunk in social gatherings, people coming together, a table in the garden, over a barbecue, in the evening, simply because that's how people buy Sentia. It's sold online, it's available, you know, on our website and through Amazon. And so people will buy it and take it home and then invite their friends. Increasingly, it's finding its way into shops and pubs, but we don't put any time or resources into that. We think that pubs are increasingly ordering it, but the percentage of vast majority of what we sell is online.
But it's interesting that because you already think that without thinking of Sentia, that the future of nightclubs will change too, because there's more and more also events where people go to experience, let's say, a sound bath or like a coming together, even if it's with dancing. Mm. But let's say this 80s, 90s idea of the hardcore nightclub, with drugs and alcohol and like, I mean, people harming themselves also with kind of trying to forget about themselves or what happened to them. So this seems to be like, it's almost like a period piece now.
I think
that if you watch movies like that, for example.
I mean, when I grew up, my parents lived overseas, and so I would travel quite a lot. And so I grew up hanging out in nightclubs as a teenager in Spain. I spent a lot of time. And Cuba Libres were the big thing, you know, rum and coke. Well, you can make an amazing Cuba Libre with black, sentient black. And with Gadir, let me show you the next one. This is still not available publicly, but with this one, which we call Gadir, this is a sample. Mm-hmm. We can make a really powerful Cuba Libre. So you can put this into Coca-Cola. And I really don't like Coca-Cola, except if it has rum. Mm-hmm. And now, if it has Gadir. And Gadir was originally designed for beer, Gabba beer. But we discovered that the underlying blend that we use for Gadir is directly usable in a whole range of formats. And so we're tweaking it now to make it work more effectively with beers and different spirits and to recreate the effect of different spirits. Sparkling wine, cider, which I already mentioned. You can make a wonderful rum and coke, basically.
So when you come here, we will do like a YouTube.
That would be fun, actually.
Show. No, we do. And we will mix all kinds of cocktails, you and me.
That's interesting. Yeah.
With Sentia. And drinking a lot. I always think about like where the self-harm also comes from. I mean, because you see that a lot of people go out and not having a good time, or maybe in the beginning, and then it borders on kind of forgetting about, like, you know, trauma maybe, or just kind of becomes a self-harming practice. Mm. Because I think the human body very fast tells you like, whoa, this is, you know, I don't feel very well if you do this like every other weekend or day. So, and I feel like sometimes the 20th century had so many tools of self-harm in store. It's something I really think about a lot, how this culture where I also grew up in, and again, especially in media, was providing you with so many tools to self-hate also in a way. Many, many things that became part of the, oh, once you grow up, you have to look into this and be able to handle this. And then some people became real addicts and nobody would actually understand what was going on with them and help them. And as we know also, I mean, it goes until the AA question, that even if people go into AA, it doesn't mean they will ever heal from their alcoholism. So it's like such a big topic to me, and it touches so many kind of rules of growing up in the 20th century, you could say. So there will be more than a YouTube show about this.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
Yeah. I understand. And there are many people who spend a good part of their life working hard to overcome some of the damage they experienced because they felt, for whatever reason, that it was necessary to live in a way that was actually harmful to them.
Yeah.
And some people didn't have a choice, so they found themselves in that situation.
Yeah, but that's why I find it so interesting that these kind of drinks and the rise of psychedelics is basically happening together, or it's even researched by somebody from the most important researchers in the modern psychedelic world.
And I think maybe two different ends of the spectrum. There's the end of the spectrum where some people may, I imagine, approach psychedelics because they want to overcome something in their life. Mm-hmm. And at the other end, it's because people want to avoid the damage that they've observed in other people.
Yeah,
and
it's true.
And this generation, if I look at my children's generation, they're not kids, they're adults now, but there are those who have went through huge trauma. You know, I knew them when they were very little, and then they, as they grew, you could observe from a distance terrible life experiences. And then they've come, most of them have come through that now. And they've chosen a lifestyle which is balanced in a way that will help them stay away from what they went through before. So I think that's part of the current generation. And the people I'm referring to have made very healthy choices. And then there are other kids of the same generation who manage to sidestep those traumas. And I think they're often making decisions to avoid falling into the trap that they've seen other people fall into. That's my generation didn't have that. I think when I was growing up, a lot of the things that we see today as being damaging and difficult were just seen as, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think we had so many examples that we could look at and say, I'm going to learn from that and I'm going to avoid it. We didn't know as much. I think the internet has changed a lot. We're much more educated. We know more stuff today. We're much more self-conscious. We talk about it. We think about it. Growing up, we just bumped into walls. You know, we crashed and burned, and some of us survived and learned a lesson and moved on. But today we learn very, very quickly. You know, the internet takes pictures and reminds you, and then we share stories. So we get to know about the damage that are around us very, very quickly. We see into other people's families because the information just becomes available. In my day, you didn't really know. You didn't really know. You had a very small circle of knowledge, I think. So I think today's generation, is there's much greater transparency. Much greater transparency. We know what's happening in LA, and we live in Bristol, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, right? I mean, you know what the Kardashians are having for breakfast.
Right.
So
yeah. So,
well, great. It was a really interesting conversation. I mean, and we should totally, you know, plan this before you come to do an evening with Santia, cocktails or morning. I mean, who cares?
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
And so thank you for being on the show, David. It was really amazing. Very interesting.
I've really enjoyed my time talking to you, Anne. And I'm looking forward to visiting you in Berlin.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Hey, and thank you for listening to this episode. Since I have you here, I just wanted to remind you, please follow us on Instagram, The New Health Club, on X, The New Health CL1, on LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our newsletter on Substack. I'm very happy if you are a returning listener and customer and fan of The New Health Club.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.